Commander Stephen, Reel 4. We were talking about your time on HMS Suffolk when you reached the East Indies station around about 1940, late 1942. Could you tell us about the one of the... we've been reading your notes, and that's going to inform the questioning from now on. What about the trip to Australia? What do you remember of that? Okay.
We went to Fremantle, which is the port of Western Australia.
What were you escorting when you went out there?
Troop ships.
And what happened when you got to Fremantle? What was your sort of reception? What was life like there?
Oh, we had a wonderful reception in Australia in those days. They were the most hospitable people to be found anywhere. Of course, Australians have a reputation for that anyway, but in those particular circumstances, because they felt a bit isolated with the Japs being pretty close, and we came from a long way away, and they were very pleased to see us.
Did you get ashore?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember what you did? Or?
Yes, well, many people were able to get ashore for, I suppose, a week and do quite a bit of exploring. I wasn't among those, but I very much enjoyed the fabled Australian hospitality, which is all that's ever been written up about it. And it was a wonderful climate at that time when we were there. And, of course, the great thing was there was no rationing. And there was whatever you wanted to eat, as much as you wanted, and drink. And, of course, this was marvellous for the sailors because beer had been in very short supply. There was a ration of about something like a small bottle per person per day. And in Australia, of course, there was no restriction at all, and there were very good beer and everything else, as good as you could get anywhere, and the most delightful people.
Now, I don't think there's much else in your memoirs about your time, but you were out there for 2 years before you were sent to dry dock, from the looks of things. Is there any other points you want to make about your time out on that station before the Suffolk went into dry dock?
No, I don't think so. I think I've told you all I can about my time in the Suffolk. But then, you see, I stayed on the East Indies station.
Now, tell me about, because you went with the Suffolk to Durban, didn't you?
Yes. That was where we docked in Durban, didn't we?
I think so.
Yes.
So what happened next then? What were the circumstances of you leaving the Suffolk?
I should have taken up my appointment in Ceylon with Commodore D, East Indies, but the... the order was issued, the station appointment was issued as a hand message, and we failed to pick it up, our postman failed to pick it up when we sailed for Durban from Trincomalee. And so I never got the order, and it was only after the ship had been some time in South Africa, because we went into dry dock in Durban, and we all had leave there in two watches, when we got a signal from Ceylon asking, "Where is Sub-Lieutenant Stephen?" And we signal back, he's here, thank you, alive and well. And the next thing was that I was to fly to Ceylon without delay. So I set about making the journey in by Imperial Airways flying boat. And this was, of course, a very rare occurrence for anybody to fly as far as that in those days. And it was extremely interesting because we had to come down for refueling pretty frequently, very frequently by modern standards. And also, we spent all nights on the ground. We never flew by night. And so I saw quite a lot of Africa. I think Suffolk, before first light one morning, wearing a greatcoat over tropical uniform to catch the Imperial Airways flying boat Cordelia, which was my sister's name, and so it was a happy omen. And our first port of call was Mozambique, which belonged to Portugal, and so it was neutral territory. But after that, all our stops were in British territory, namely Mombasa, Lake Victoria, Khartoum and Cairo. I don't think I'm actually entitled to call those last two British, but for practical purposes they were. These were night stops for which we were taken to a high-grade hotel. There were also a couple of refueling stops each day when a motorboat would come out, come alongside and take the passengers off to a jetty with an awning over it or some such, where we would be issued with lemonade and biscuits and so on. And then we go putting back in a motorboat to the flying boat, which would be anchored while we were ashore. I find this fascinating to remember. It is so different from long-range flights today.
Carry on.
Yes. We had some meals served in flight, very much like they do today. But we only flew in daylight, so breakfast and dinner were usually taken in hotels. And another difference from modern air travel was that we never flew very high. And whenever there was something worth looking at, wildlife in Kenya, for example, or the Abu Simbel statues, we were brought down low so as to have a good look. We also had a whole day to spare in Cairo because of a change of... We changed planes there. So we did the Sphinx and the pyramids like proper tourists. When our journey was resumed, it was in the flying boat Carnation. She took us to Basra for a night stop by the Dead Sea, where it was comical to see people floating in a sitting position with their head, chest and knees out of the water. I dipped my finger in just to taste, and just the taste of the salt on my finger was enough to almost make me sick. On the second day, we reached Karachi, where we ceased to be passengers of Imperial Airways and were in the hands of the RAF for passage to Ceylon. The aircraft was a Dakota and the crew Polish. When we made our takeoff run and reached unstick speed, the plane did not rise, The pilot managed to bring us to a stop right at the end of the runway, and a Polish flight lieutenant got out, disappeared from sight at the tail of the aircraft, and reappeared waving in either hand one of the chocks that were inserted in the tailplane while on the ground to hold the elevator still. He was almost incapable of standing, being literally helpless with laughter. And another member of the crew, who went to help him, was in like case. When we were approaching Colombo's airport, a lieutenant of the Fleet Air Arm was invited from his seat in front of mine and escorted to the flight deck. There, our runway was pointed out to him, and he was told to put her down there, and the whole crew came aft to sit with the passengers. When we came into land, it was disconcerting to bounce on each wheel in turn, while first one wingtip and then the other scored the grass. When the doors were opened, the whole crew got out first and did their rolling about act, while the passengers followed more soberly. And finally, the lieutenant who had landed the plane, looking distinctly pale and shaking. He told me subsequently that he was out of practice in alighting on dry land, had not flown a twin-engine plane before, and had no passenger license. I suppose this attitude, contrasting so starkly with the attention to safety in every aspect of aviation today, was exceptional even in wartime. Having completed my urgent journey, except for crossing the island to Trincomalee, I was given accommodation in a transit camp where I spent a further week awaiting my turn for a berth on the night train. The accommodation was under canvas and stark. Food was plentiful, but drinks were rationed. A bottle of beer a week, and chits entitling one to a third of a gill each of brandy, gin, and whiskey a day. The day I was scheduled to leave on the night train was 11th of August 1944, my 21st birthday. So, at 6 o'clock, as the bar opened, I ordered a gin at the bar, presenting my chit for the same. A moment later, an army officer came in. I told him what the occasion was and invited him to have a drink with me, which he accepted, using my whiskey chit. After that, he kindly stood the other half, using his chits, and then it was time for dinner before I was due to leave. So that was how I celebrated my majority. I'd already been detailed as courier to carry the confidential mail from Colombo to Trincomalee, which meant I had a first-class twin-berth sleeping compartment to myself and my bags, and was met by transport on arrival next morning. I then joined HMS Woolwich, wearing the broad pennant of Commodore A.P. Patsy Poland, DSO, DSC.
So were you, what were you doing? What was your role for Poland?
I was Assistant Secretary.
Now, what did that entail? What did you actually have to do, in fact?
All his correspondence. We had writers in the office who actually opened the mail and that sort of thing, but then I would have to read it first and minute it to the appropriate staff officers or send it direct to the Commodore with my comments, whatever seemed to be appropriate.
Now, one of the things you went on was on a trip on HMS, when he became Naval Forces Commander Burma.
That's right.
Now, tell us about that.
Right. About the date. On the 1st of February 1945, Commodore Poland was given the temporary appointment of Naval Force Commander Burma. This was because the Admiral was recalled from Burma to Ceylon to plan the invasion of Malaya.
Now, what did this mean for you?
What it meant for me was sailing with the Commodore in the destroyer HMS Venus for Akyab on the Arakan coast.
Now, can you describe the naval headquarters you set up at Akyab?
It consisted of a hut, which was furnished with a collapsible table, and we called that the staff in the centre, and we called that the staff office. And there were partitions to make a small room in each corner. The Commodore had two of these at one end, known as his day cabin and his night cabin. Myself and the other staff officers, who were provided locally, had the other two. I was able to acquire... yes, that's right. We had two... we each had a double cabin, in fact, was what it amounted to.
And what were you actually doing there?
We were there to maintain a naval connection with the army while the Rear Admiral, whose business it was, went back to the headquarters in Kandy.
So what was this liaison role? What exactly were you doing?
Well, the army were preparing the recapture of Burma and Malaya.
But how were you liaising with them? Or do you not remember? That's fair enough.
Well, I think the point is, don't write from him, I think the point of it all was that you could send each other letters in way back, but they thought it was necessary if one was planning an assault on occupied Japanese occupied territories, that there should be people on the ground and talking to each other.
And that's what you were doing.
And that's what my Commodore was doing.
Now, a lot of the time you were there, you seem to have been on collecting witness statements for a court-martial of an officer. Now, can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. Now, let me see. How did we ever hear about him in the first place?
It doesn't matter. Just tell me about collecting the witness statements.
Yes, well, there had been an officer on the station, and there were a number of allegations made about him, and it was decided that he ought to be brought to trial by a court-martial. And this meant it was necessary to take formal statements from the witnesses, and a number of whom were in Burma at that time. So it was my job to go around and visit these people and take statements from them.
And what do you remember of that? Because it seems to have been an extraordinary time for you.
Yes, it was extraordinary because one was travelling from place to place in Burma by air, a little aircraft, light aircraft, and it was all extremely informal. One just went along and in effect took the first plane on the rank, and many of them were manned by the Royal Air Force and about an equal number by the United States Air Force. So you might go in one or the other. And you simply introduced yourself, said where you wanted to go, and they gave you a flying kit to put on over your tropical rig, and took you wherever you wanted.
Now, some of these trips were quite exciting. Could you give us an idea of what it was like trying to track these officers down?
Yes. Well, I didn't have any contact with the ground from the air. There was no cordless telephone or anything of that sort. So one had to come down and then see who was there and start to try and find your way. Yes, the cab rank from which one got one's aeroplane could be either RAF or USAF. And I remember on one occasion when I just alighted and the aircraft had just alighted and I was taking off my flying kit and giving back when we saw a column of dust coming towards us, which was recognisable as a jeep at high speed. And when it came up, we found it was an American in it who said, "Get the hell out of here, quick. The Japs are still here." And so we took off again in a hurry. Fortunately, the pilot waited for me to put on my flying overalls again and climb in behind him, and off we went.
Any other such close escapes, or was that the worst?
I wouldn't say the worst. Perhaps it was the most interesting.
Now, you were doing this for quite a while, and then the end of the war came as a bit of a surprise to you, didn't it? Could you tell us that story about how you first discovered about the atomic bomb?
Shortly after the Commodore and I returned to Trincomalee, he arranged for the general who had commanded 15 Corps at ACAB, he'd arranged for him to pay him a visit in Trincomalee, and he was going to have lunch with the Commodore. He arrived in a remote corner of that vast harbour very early in the morning, and I was sent in the Commodore's barge to collect him. So I made a rendezvous with him, all right, and got him back, got him on board the barge, and we set off for the trip back to HMS Woolwich, which was the depot ship where the Commodore lived. And the general opened the conversation by saying, "What do you think about this bomb, then?" I hadn't the remotest idea what he was talking about. And somehow managed to keep a conversation going until we got back to the depot ship, the Woolwich. And when I returned on board, I found everybody was talking about the atom bomb. And then we were all taken completely by surprise when the Japanese surrendered a few days later.
So you had no idea of what an atom bomb was at the time?
Not the remotest idea. I think one was vaguely aware that it was a bomb which must have done what we used to call splitting the atom, which had been a sort of theoretical possibility.
So you were aware of that, the possibility, but not that it was there?
No, and no idea that if you would make bombs and that sort of thing.
Were there any celebrations?
Of course there were. Yes, in fact, the way I put this was that we'd all expected that the war was going to take years of hard fighting, winking out the very last Jap from the very last hiding place. But after this atom bomb, the war ended almost immediately. And, of course, there were celebrations. And that was followed by a stern general signal from the commander-in-chief to the effect that we must all be prepared for surprise attacks by the Japanese. But it soon became clear that the emperor's order to surrender was being obeyed comprehensively, and that there was no further danger from the Japs.
The next thing was that you were made the captain's secretary aboard HMS Caradoc. I'm not quite sure the pronunciation now. I know you is special, and you were on a journey back to Devonport. Now, what could you tell us? Well, two things. One is what were your duties as captain's secretary aboard HMS Caradoc?
Well, every ship in the Navy. That's not quite true. Yes, the cruisers and upwards had every captain had a secretary, whose duties varied very largely depending on one's master. But basically, you were responsible for the all the correspondence going into and out of the ship to make sure that it was properly recorded and that it was referred to the appropriate staff officers for information or for proposed action as might be required.
And another point I know that you remember is that there were rats aboard this ship, which is quite unusual. Tell us about the rats.
Yes. The Caradoc had been ashore, had been alongside in a dockyard as a virtually dead ship. She was just there to provide accommodation for people in transit. And during that time, she had become full of rats. And the evidence of this was forced itself upon one's consciousness every day, because if you just left your shoes on the deck beside your bunk, in the morning you would find that they would be nibbled all around the edges.
It was that bad.
It was that bad. And occasionally, these rats would chase each other around the nooks and crannies, including the overhead, and you might get one dropping on you, or dropping onto your dinner table, so something like that. So it was very, very unpleasant indeed.
Was there anything done about it, or could anything be done about it?
Well, there were traps put up, and I can remember distinctly the awful noise that happened when a rat was caught in the trap in my cabin. It was overhead on a rat runway, a sort of on top of the ventilation shafts, and it made the most awful squealing noise, as you might expect, unless it had been killed outright, which obviously it hadn't. And of course, it was chucking its weight about, and then the trap fell onto my bunk with a rat in it. It was all extremely unpleasant.